Hi everybody, and welcome to Footnotes, a podcast by the Sydney University Law Society for law students, by law students, and as always, sponsored by the very generous Gilbert and Tobin. I'm David, your host from part one of this interview, and in part two, we're going to finish off the remainder of our law school legend chat with Professor Peter Gerangelis. You'll hear about his tips for future students of FedCon, possibly learn something unexpected about him, and we will, yes, we will tackle the big question of how he feels about that famous Facebook fan page. But we'll start off where we left off in part one, when we were discussing how sometimes constitutional scholarship can be taken for granted, and how the public doesn't always necessarily appreciate the importance of our constitutional safeguards. Following that, we'll get on to the recent US election, all the kerfuffle surrounding that, and the professor's own take on the public's burgeoning interest in the constitutional procedures of the United States of America. Grab your cup of coffee, your bag of popcorn, kick back, and please enjoy. I've seen in like discursive spheres for the Americans where like people who otherwise would have had no idea what was going on tell you what the constitutional procedure was for counting ballots in Nevada.
Yes, no, that's right.
Or what the administrator of the American General Services Administration does. And it is, you know, it's amazing in a sense that even, you know, I've got friends here who are not into politics at all. They wouldn't have the singlest, faintest clue about Australian politics. Yes. Tell me all these things about the US election and all the contingencies, but also terrifying at the same time because, you know, you go, well, what was the root cause of that, that engagement?
Yeah, but I think my previous comments are not to suggest that ignorance of the constitutional situation or lack of appreciation of the freedoms that, that it enshrines here is necessarily of itself a good thing.
Right.
Of course, it's important that we do have a greater appreciation only to the extent that we protect it. And of course, you know, there are certain aspects of the United States and the way they do things which then garners that greater interest because they tend to be more controversial. I mean, the current situation where you have a president that is refusing to concede, at least to my current knowledge, garners a lot of interest in the Constitution and what happens. I mean, if that weren't to happen and there would be, as we've had in Australia, just normal concessions, that sort of interest wouldn't necessarily arise. So we mustn't take things for granted. And I also should add, as a further point here, that it's not to say that it's perfect. A lot of things need to be reconsidered, perhaps, that reform of the Constitution in certain aspects is something that does need to be considered. So my comments are very general. It's not meant to suggest that we haven't got a way to go to improve things.
On that specific tangent, I've heard it said that compared to a parliamentary system, the presidential system is America's most dangerous export. Did you have any?
Yeah, no, look, people do say that, but I think it has to be remembered that they do have checks and balances built into their system, but to the extent that it does give the executive, like a non-parliamentary executive, greater power, and it may not work in other countries.
Yeah.
And that's a consequence of the fact that when the American Constitution was written, our system of responsible government, the Westminster notion of parliamentary government, that the government of the day is responsible to Parliament and the members of the government must also be members of Parliament, and that the executive, or the Governor General in our case, can only act on advice of elected representatives in Parliament who form the government. That had not been fully formed at the time that the Constitution of the United States was written.
Right.
So therefore, they had this greater sense of executive power, but of course balanced. Now, why it's a dangerous export is that it's a dangerous export because countries where this is exported to may not have developed that political culture which requires and understands a restraint in presidential power. Whereas, and I don't think this is, you know, controversial at all to say that at the time that the Americans were writing their constitution, that there were the Federalist Papers, there was a far greater appreciation, for example, of the experiences in ancient history, both Athenian politics and Roman, you know, the politics of the Roman Republic and virtues, constitutional values and virtues were very strong in the mind of the framers.
Mm.
So you can have the best written constitution in the world, but if there's no political culture of understanding the limits to power, of self-restraint, of balance, of citizens who are worthy to be in the sense that they've cultivated a sense of the importance of the public sphere and the need for restraint and avoiding dictatorships. If people don't have that culture, the constitution is not going to provide it, and that will be, you know, overwritten. Because at the end of the day, if you do have a determined autocrat who seizes control, let's say, of the armed forces that are with him, what's a piece of paper at the end of the day going to do?
Exactly, just words.
So, and that goes back to my fascination, you see, with constitutional law. You need to have those written legal constraints as higher law in there, but at the same time, it's essential for societies to cultivate within their citizenry the understanding of what it means to be a citizen in a democratic country and the limits you need to place on your own conduct, ethical and otherwise, in order for it to, you know, survive. And if you look back, of course, and I talked about ancient history, look at Cicero, Cato, for example, in their struggles against Caesar. They saw him for what he really was.
Sure.
But you need to have people like that to be able to restrain. But going back to your ultimate, your original question, yes, it can be a dangerous export, but their very greatest export has been the, you know, the idea of constitutional values and democratic freedoms and civil rights and so on, which has been spread.
And on that, I guess, civic spirit sort of idea, you know, you talked about Caesar, obviously, the past 4 years in America.
Yeah.
It is, you know, fascinating and a little bit scary.
Yes.
Even if you got all this, you know, all pervasive culture, whether it's 700 years of Rome or 200 years of America, how a single individual or very small handful of individuals can cause that spirit to degrade in a very rapid manner.
That's right. And we've had ample examples in history where this sort of thing can happen. And that's why, I should add, education in that regard is very important, and why ancient history and some of them, at least the more important episodes, are very valuable for students to be familiar with. Perhaps we ought to have a list of books that law students should read. I mean, I actually have, again, international students sometimes approach me after a class and ask me for this, because I might mention, as an aside, some historical anecdote, and they want books on this, and who do I read on this? I have to add that, and I wasn't going necessarily to talk about this, but I remember at school reading Plato's account of the trial and death of Socrates, which had a profound effect on me, because you've just had the great Athenian democracy, and then you've got war happens, civil war, or, well, civil war, I suppose, but war happens, and the leaders die in a plague, you know, the great leaders, and then you've got the demagogues coming to power, and somebody like Socrates is asking too many questions and making a nuisance of himself to them. And then there's a show trial, and he's charged with ridiculous things like corrupting the youth and, you know, making the weaker argument the stronger, while the charges against him, you see. And ultimately, of course, you have a judicial murder. Where does that come?
Yeah.
That doesn't come at some, in some society that's been used to tyrannical or autocratic rule. That emerges from within a democracy, which the point you just made, that the whole thing loses itself when you have certain individuals who don't appreciate these values.
Which, like that.
Yes, very quickly. Of course, the benefit to us was that as a result of that trial and the eventual execution of Socrates, who was forced to drink hemlock, which is, apart from the pathos of that book, ultimately, it led Plato to give up public life and start what we would know as the university, in the sense of the academy, where he left public life and started philosophizing because he was so disillusioned with what had been happening at the time. And it's the survival of these ideas through Rome and through more modern European history that give us these benefits that we have in, you know, more democratic, liberal, democratic societies. But it's important that we're aware of that, and it's important that somewhere in our educational system, if I might be permitted to make this remark, that these things are stressed.
Sure.
And not just left at the individual whim of the interest of particular students.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. Well, moving on to, I guess it's speed round, but not really.
That's all right. No, I will be quicker, if you wish. Yes.
No, that's fine. Yeah. Did you have any passion projects or just projects in general you've been working on either during the lockdown or throughout?
No, not really, I have to say. It's more a case of just reading a number of books, believe it or not. You'd think I'd have enough of it, but no, right. Just reading a number of books just for the sake of interest. I've always wanted to read some of the novels of François Mauriac, which I have done. But back to theme, also reading a biography of Lincoln, which I heard was very good.
Right.
Yeah.
Which biography?
It was the very best biography, but it just arrived yesterday at home.
Right.
So the author's just escaped me for the moment.
I know you've said a lot about the wonders and the joys of teaching, but is there something specifically about this university that you enjoy or maybe not quite so much?
Oh, well, look, I mean, as a student here, I do think that we received a very high-class legal education at this law school.
Yeah.
So, you know, it had always been my preference to work here. I just believed that the rigour and the standard has always been very high. That's no reflection on other places, I just don't know. But, of course, I've always enjoyed being part of this law school. You can laugh at this if you wish, but I think I've said to you before, it's just that pure delight in teaching, that in that dialogue between the mind of the tutor and the student on issues that are rather profound interest or sheer technical complexity. It's also the joy of watching or having the opportunity to witness students breaking the bounds of their own self-imposed limits. To challenge them enough, and I do strongly believe in this. It does students no good to make things easy for them, even though at the time they may not like it, because it's especially the students that get into this law school do need to be challenged.
Yeah.
And if they break their own, what they thought were their own boundaries, and they have those, you know, profound moments of insight, it's one of the most enjoyable things, A, to witness that, and also to be a facilitator of that, because we're really ultimately no more than that. If I can just give you a couple of examples, just the student that I came across a couple of years ago who, because of just a lack of confidence, had never competed in any moot,
right,
but thought he would make an attempt at the advanced constitutional law assessment moot, and he was just brilliant.
Mm.
But no one had told him this before, and he lacked the confidence. And hopefully he takes that forward. But he was just overjoyed at the fact that he really was quite brilliant, but just never had the confidence.
Right.
And also, and this happens often in constitutional law, in the compulsory, for example, you know, you have the odd student who might come to me and just inspired when the implications dawned on that student of the ultimate indeterminacy of constitutional limitations on the defence power in times of war. And he actually thought that was, you know, quite profound and something that needed to be worked through.
Right.
Worked through. The other good things about teaching at the university is getting emails from students who didn't necessarily do very well in the course, but then write to thank you nevertheless, which is always very good.
Yeah.
And being approached by what appear to be random people in the street who turn out to be former students, who just want to come over and say hello and express their thanks. I mean, that's a very nice thing that can happen.
Sure.
From time to time. It happens quite often, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any real standout students you've had in the past?
Yes, but I won't mention names. It's probably. But, yeah, no.
Any that have gone on to become?
Well, I don't think I've been teaching long enough for them to have become judges yet,
right.
So I've only been teaching for 20 years.
Right.
But in the sense of, you know,
it's nothing given the idea,
they wouldn't have quite reached that level. But perhaps if I stay on long enough, they will be.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll see some of your fans on
the
bench.
Yeah, well, hopefully.
Perhaps.
Hopefully. Yeah.
But speaking of teaching, is there anything, you know, future FedCon students should watch out for in your course? Any pet peeves as a professor?
Well, I suppose the pet peeves would be the same as a teacher. I don't want to complain because I am fortunate to hold the position here. But to be frank with you, some of the things that can be difficult, if you'll permit me to say so, is having on occasion to deal with a student whose conduct exhibits an absence or even a deficit at times of just common courtesy,
sure,
who completely lack a sense of humour or proportion. those can be difficult situations. Disappointing, really. I think the other thing that's disappointing is coming across cases of breaches of academic integrity by students who try to game the system for their advantage and ultimately not understanding. Here's the disappointment. Ultimately, you're going to be lawyers. And if you started already, even as a law student, for want of a better term, there's no other way to put it, cheat. Heaven help us when you get into the profession, because it's only going to go downhill from there. But I must say these are very rare cases. The other thing that's a little bit disappointing is students who do not heed feedback that's given to them. They don't want to understand, it seems, that they need to improve. They think that they're good enough. That's a very bad attitude to have, just as at a personal level as well. And I'm not talking about criticism, which is unfounded, but I think you've got to be open to feedback which you can feel is genuinely being made.
Absolutely.
And you know, for students to know their limitations and how to improve. I mean, how else can you improve?
Yeah.
And just finally, I think there's this general attitude that you sometimes see of a transactional approach being taken to studies. In other words, it's just a means to an end. This is not necessarily the fault of students, I find. It's the general ethos that has been creeping into society, that university is seen as a means to a job.
Mm.
And this makes me very sad because I think university is one of the few opportunities that you'll have just to learn for learning's sake. You'll never get it back again. And one of the laments you'll hear, not now, but later on, the number of practitioners who lament the fact that when they were at law school, they didn't spend more time just learning and appreciating the freedom they had to do this. I mean, law students often say that they're very stressed. They are. Look, I'm not denying that at all. But once you hit full-time legal practice, you have no idea really what it can be like.
Yeah.
So my point is, it's not so much a warning to any particular student. It's just some advice to take to appreciate the time you have here and the fact that you have an opportunity just to learn.
Sure.
Yeah.
I, back in high school, had a history teacher who, well into his late 30s, but he was still on, I think, multiple doctorates. He was doing something related to Soviet cartoons. Very interesting. But I remember once asking him, I said, you know, sir, you've got a very, very busy job, very good job here at the school. Why are you still doing, you know, you don't seem to have any inclination to move up to a university. Yes. Why are you still doing this? And he said, well, look, it's about once you leave school, once you leave education, you can't really ever come back in the same way that you did. So he said, he still wants to learn. He still wants to be in the system while he can.
Yes, yes, that's right. Well, the other thing, of course, with that attitude is that even as you, throughout your life, and especially as you get older and you're looking at retirement, you'll never be bored.
Mm.
There's always something that you're forever pursuing, and hence that childlike quality I was referring to you.
Mm.
And often once you get on a theme, you want to, whatever that theme might be, to pursue it to its end, to get to the bottom of something. Is an intrinsically interesting, I mean, not everybody has that attitude, but I'd like to think that to the extent that you can cultivate a degree of it, it's good for your health, just your own well-being, that you're not just driven by the pursuit of a career, whatever that career might be. But then again, as I've pointed out, the way society is being structured, the way a world of work generally, and legal work can be very, very demanding. It's very easy for you to forget that aspect and just not look out for what, how can I put it, feeds your mind and gives you some fulfillment in that regard. So your old teacher was on the right track there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Yes.
What is something about you that may be unexpected, be it an unusual hobby or a fact Yes. Or, you know.
Well, look, I'm not sure what you expect, so it's very difficult to answer that question. I mean, I would love to say, for example, that I run marathons, but no one would believe me. So I really I'm really unable to answer that question.
Right.
Beyond that, it's I'm sure there are many unexpected things, but it's difficult for me to say what they might
Where
be.
Where was the last marathon?
I never ran a marathon. Right. That's what I'm saying.
Oh,
I'd
right.
love to say that I do. I'd love to say that I do, but I don't. And if I did say that, no one would believe me. So, in other words, what I'm getting at is I wish there was something that I could think of, but unexpected. But
yeah. Well, I did believe you for a second. I believed you for a second.
No, I was kidding.
No, we should have left that just at that in the interview and see how many people... You know,
one would have believed. No.
I suppose we already touched on the last book that you've read or are going to read, but I just more broadly, I guess, in the last year or two, any favourites?
Yeah, no, the very last book I read was, or reread, I'd read it when I was a student, is a very interesting book called The Glass Bead Game by Hermann Hesse. I do recommend it. It has some very interesting insights. And perhaps that book, quite coincidentally, touches on some of the themes that I have been discussing here. It's a fascinating book, and I won't say anything more about it. But so it's Hermann Hesse's The Glass Bead Game.
Yeah. All right, everyone. You hear that? The Glass Bead Game. Hermann Hesse. Please get on it. I'm sure it's very interesting. I'll be looking it up myself.
Okay.
And just very lastly,
yes.
Obviously, as you know, there is a dedicated fan page set up for you on Facebook. I know you don't have social media,
no.
But obviously, you know, there is a popularity and a following amongst the students for you. How do you feel about it? And what do you think is the cause of that?
Well, I mean, naturally, to the extent that is the case, I am very grateful. But it is, quite honestly, very unexpected. When I started lecturing, I actually thought that I would be rather unpopular. Students wouldn't appreciate my methods, perhaps later when they practice. And the reason is that given my own experience in practice and knowing what young lawyers will face, I promised myself from the start that I would not compromise on standards, on attention to detail that's demanded, basically so as not to sell students short in their preparation. So as I said, I thought, given that sort of rigorous approach, which I experienced as a law student, which was very tough, I thought I'd be unpopular. So I'm very grateful that students appreciate that. But as I say, it's unexpected. As for the cause, I honestly don't know. Sometimes I think it's a case of mass delusion, if you permit me to say that. Or maybe if I think about it, and since you asked the question, maybe it's a result of the fact that I don't think it's a good idea to speak down to students, that it's best to treat them with respect and only use firmness when necessary. Perhaps it's that trace of kindliness and sympathy toward the young, which is a consequence of age and experience. Maybe that comes through. I don't know. And there is that line from classical literature, which comes to mind from time to time, which is, a god from afar looks graciously upon a gentle master. So maybe that has all something to do with it. I don't know. But as I say, I do appreciate it, and but it's very unexpected. And I honestly don't think, and I've said this to other people, I honestly don't think that I'm doing anything particularly special, but just doing the best I can to teach students.
That may be why. To doing the best you can over 20 Maybe. Years.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that is all we have for you today, Professor.
Thank you.
Thank you so, so much for agreeing to this
interview.
No,
thank you too. I appreciate you asking me very much. And so I'm very grateful for being asked to talk to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Good. Thank you.